Hello and welcome to the Pediatric Critical Care Medicine Audio Abstracts. I'm Dr. Erin Bennett, and on behalf of PCCM, I'm happy to present this audio recording of the research abstracts that appear in this month's issue. Let's get started. Abstract 1 is a featured original research article by Hames et al. Extubation failure in neonates following congenital cardiac surgery, multicenter retrospective cohort from 2017 to 2020. Objectives. Extubation failure in neonates recovering from congenital cardiac surgery is associated with morbidity and mortality. Adding continuous physiologic monitoring data and risk analytics algorithms to clinical factors has the potential to assist clinicians in identifying those neonates at high risk for extubation failure. We aim to evaluate the association of two physiologic risk analytics algorithms evaluating the probability of an adequate delivery of oxygen index and inadequate ventilation of carbon dioxide index with extubation failure in neonates receiving mechanical ventilation after cardiac surgery. A secondary aim was to evaluate the clinical factors associated with extubation failure. Design: multicenter retrospective cohort study. Setting: 8 international pediatric cardiac ICUs. Patients: neonates aged less than 1 month at the time of surgery receiving mechanical ventilation for longer than 48 hours following cardiac surgery between January 1, 2017 and December 31, 2020. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Data from 736 neonates were analyzed, with 102 having extubation failure, or 13.9%. Extubation failure was defined as reintubation within 48 hours of extubation. In multivariable analysis, preoperative respiratory support was associated with greater odds of extubation failure, with an odds ratio of 1.72 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.11 to 2.67. In all, 611 neonates had pre-extubation inadequate delivery of oxygen index data, and 478 neonates had both pre-extubation inadequate delivery of oxygen index data and inadequate ventilation of carbon dioxide index data. In multivariable analysis of patients with both pre-extubation inadequate delivery of oxygen index and high inadequate ventilation of carbon dioxide index data, single ventricle anatomy with an odds ratio of 2.5 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.27 to 4.92, and high inadequate delivery of oxygen index greater than or equal to 25, or high inadequate ventilation of carbon dioxide index greater than or equal to 50 in the 2 hours preceding extubation with an odds ratio of 1.77 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.01 to 3.12 were associated with greater odds of extubation failure. Conclusions. In this 2017 to 2020 cohort, extubation failure is high in post-cardiac surgery neonates receiving at least 48 hours of mechanical ventilation. The inadequate delivery of oxygen index and inadequate ventilation of carbon dioxide index algorithms may be useful in assessing risk of extubation failure in such neonates. Abstract 2 is a featured original research article by White et al. Acute respiratory distress syndrome in children with lower respiratory tract infections requiring invasive mechanical ventilation. Post-hoc analysis of the 2019 to 2020 bronchiolitis and co-detection cohort. Objectives. Bronchiolitis and other lower respiratory tract infections are the most common causes of pediatric respiratory failure. There is insufficient evidence characterizing pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome in young children with lower respiratory tract infections to inform clinical management. We aim to describe the prevalence and clinical characteristics of children intubated for lower respiratory tract infection and meeting pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome criteria. Design. We performed a post-hoc analysis of data from the Bronchiolitis and Co-Detection, or BACON study, an international prospective observational study of critical bronchiolitis. We compared pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome, or pediatric ARDS, subjects meeting criteria the first full calendar day following intubation to non-pediatric ARDS subjects. Setting: 48 international PICUs recruiting to the BACON study from December 2019 to November 2020. Patients: children younger than 2 years old requiring mechanical ventilation for acute lower respiratory tract infection. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Complete data were available for 571 children. Day 1 pediatric ARDS was diagnosed in 240 subjects, or 42%, and associated with increased mortality, 7.9% versus 2.7%, with a p-value equal to 0.023, greater duration of invasive ventilation, 165 hours with an interquartile range of 112 to 251 hours versus 135 hours with an interquartile range of 76 to 204 hours and a p-value less than 0.001, and PICU length of stay, 11 days with an interquartile range of 7 to 16 days versus 8 days with an interquartile range of 5 to 13 days and a p-value less than 0.001. In our multivariable competing risk model, the presence of pediatric ARDS on day 1 was causally related to a prolonged duration of mechanical ventilation with the probability of extubation at 7 days for those with pediatric ARDS equal to 49% with a range of 44 to 54% compared with 64% with a range of 59 to 69% for those without pediatric ARDS. Conclusions. Pediatric ARDS development was common in this critical bronchiolitis cohort, resulted in a longer duration of mechanical ventilation, and was associated with increased mortality and PICU length of stay. Prospective studies are needed to elucidate the optimal management of critical bronchiolitis. Abstract 3 is a featured original research article by Balcarrel et al. Development and Validation of an Electronic Health Record-Based Pediatric Acute Respiratory Distress Syndrome Subphenotype Classifier Model. Objective: to determine if hyperinflammatory and hypoinflammatory pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome or pediatric ARDS subphenotypes defined using serum biomarkers can be determined solely from electronic health record or EHR data using machine learning. Design: retrospective exploratory analysis using data from 2014 to 2022. Setting: single-center quaternary care PICU. Patients: two temporally distinct cohorts of pediatric ARDS patients from 2014 to 2019 and 2019 to 2022. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Patients in the derivation cohort with an N equal to 333 were assigned to be hyperinflammatory or hypoinflammatory subphenotypes using biomarkers and latent class analysis. A machine learning model was trained on 165 EHR-derived variables to identify subphenotypes. The most important variables were selected for inclusion in a parsimonious model. The model was validated in a separate cohort with an N equal to 114. The EHR-based classifier achieved an area under the receiver operating characteristic curve, or AUC, of 0.93, with a 95% confidence interval of 0.87 to 0.98, with a sensitivity of 88% and specificity of 83% for determining hyperinflammatory pediatric ARDS. The parsimonious model, using only 5 laboratory values, achieved an AUC of 0.92 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.86 to 0.98 with a sensitivity of 76% and specificity of 87% in the validation cohort. Conclusions. This proof-of-concept study demonstrates that biomarker-based pediatric ARDS subphenotypes can be identified using EHR data at 24 hours of pediatric ARDS diagnosis. Further validation in larger multicenter cohorts is needed to confirm the clinical utility of this approach. Abstract 4 is a featured original research article by Solomon et al. Syndican 1 as a biomarker for fluid overload after high-risk pediatric cardiac surgery, a pilot study. Objective: fluid overload after pediatric cardiac surgery with cardiopulmonary bypass is common and has been associated with poor outcomes. We aim to describe the relationship between plasma concentrations of syndican 1, a biomarker of endothelial glycocalyx injury, and fluid overload in a cohort of children undergoing cardiac surgery. Design: single-center prospective observational pilot study from 2022 to 2023. Setting: 26-bed pediatric cardiac ICU at a quaternary pediatric referral center. Patients: children younger than 18 years old undergoing Society of Thoracic Surgeons European Association for Cardiothoracic Surgery Congenital Heart Surgery Mortality Category 3, 4, and 5 cardiac surgeries with cardiopulmonary bypass. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We enrolled 15 patients. Blood samples were collected preoperatively and 4 hours postoperatively, then processed for plasma. Syndican 1 concentrations were measured using enzyme-linked immunosorbent assays and compared with fluid balance on postoperative days 1, 2, 3, and peak. Syndican 1 discriminated fluid balance of greater than or equal to 10% on postoperative day 1, postoperative day 2, and postoperative day 3, with an area under the receiver operating characteristic curve, or AUROC, of 0.74, 0.84, and 0.88, respectively. Syndican 1 also discriminated peak fluid balance of greater than or equal to 10% occurring on any day over the first 7 postoperative days with an AUROC of 0.94. Patients with greater than or equal to 10% fluid balance on postoperative day 2 with a p-value equal to 0.037, postoperative day 3 with a p-value equal to 0.020, or peak with a p-value equal to 0.021 had significantly elevated delta syndican 1 when compared with those reaching less than 10%. Fluid balance of greater than or equal to 10% on postoperative day 2 was associated with adverse events including longer duration of mechanical ventilation and cardiac ICU stay. Conclusions: plasma syndican 1 was associated with fluid overload in pediatric patients undergoing high-risk cardiac surgery with cardiopulmonary bypass. Further studies exploring the clinical utility of syndican 1 as a biomarker for fluid overload in the postoperative management of children who undergo cardiac surgery with cardiopulmonary bypass should be pursued. Abstract 5 is a featured original research article by Clapp et al. Area-level socioeconomic disadvantage and post-PICU outcomes in children with an acquired brain injury, single-center retrospective cohort from 2016 to 2023. Objectives: to examine associations between measures of area-level socioeconomic disadvantage and disability outcomes in children with acquired brain injury after PICU hospitalization. Design: retrospective cohort study. Setting: tertiary academic children's hospital. Patients: children 3 to 19 years old admitted to the PICU for acquired brain injury from 2016 to 2023 who completed a post-PICU follow-up clinic visit 1 to 3 months after discharge. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. In 455 children with acquired brain injury, median age of 10.8 years with an interquartile range of 6.6 to 14.2 years, we measured area-level socioeconomic disadvantage with the Child Opportunity Index, or COI, higher scores equal less disadvantage, and Area Deprivation Index, or ADI, higher scores equal more disadvantage, reference to state. COI was categorized by quintile, very low to very high, and ADI was grouped into the lowest 3, middle 4, and highest 3 deciles. New disability was defined as greater than or equal to 1 point increase from baseline in functional status scale total score at follow-up. New disability was present in 97 of 455 children, or 21.3%. New disability, low COI, and high ADI were independently associated with severity of illness. Multivariable logistic regression controlling for demographic and clinical covariates showed very high versus very low COI was associated with 60% lesser odds of new disability at follow-up, with an adjusted odds ratio of 0.41 and a 95% confidence interval of 0.17 to 0.99. We failed to identify such an association comparing the low to high ADI group with an adjusted odds ratio of 0.59 and a 95% confidence interval of 0.3 to 1.16, but we are unable to exclude the possibility that living in advantaged areas was associated with up to 70% lesser odds of new disability at follow-up. Conclusions: in children with acquired brain injury, we have found that area-level socioeconomic disadvantage is associated with greater odds of post-PICU disability when controlling for other demographic and severity of illness characteristics. Future research is needed to identify modifiable targets to reduce disparities in PICU outcomes after acquired brain injury. Abstract 6 is a clinical investigation article by Weber et al. Reduced severity of arterial catheter-associated proximal ischemic injuries through a quality improvement initiative. Objectives: to define and reduce the incidence of severe arterial catheter-associated proximal ischemic injuries. Design: quality improvement, or QI, initiative. Setting: university-affiliated PICU in a quaternary children's hospital. Patients: all patients with indwelling arterial catheters in the PICU at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia from January 2020 to December 2022. Interventions: Phase 1 from January 2021 to December 2021 included defining arterial catheter-associated proximal ischemic injuries and daily rounding on all arterial catheters by a dedicated PICU-specific vascular access team. Phase 2 from January 2022 to December 2022 introduced standardized recommendations and interventions, including the use of topical nitroglycerin ointment, or TNG, as a therapeutic option for mild injuries. Measurements and main results. From January 2021 to December 2022, the rounding team evaluated 1,916 arterial catheters for a total of 5,793 rounding episodes or line days. During phase one, the overall number of arterial catheter-associated proximal ischemic injuries increased compared with prior year pre-quarter one, 35 versus 11, or 318%. During phase two, the administration of topical nitroglycerin was associated with an increase in arterial line days per arterial catheter in patients with mild injury, 6.58 line days per line, 158 days for 24 lines, compared with pre-quarter 1, phase 1, and phase 2 mild injuries without the use of topical nitroglycerin, 3.27 line days per line, 198 days for 61 lines, and an incident rate difference of 3.31 with a 95% confidence interval of 2.11 to 4.51 and a p-value less than 0.001. Special cause indicators shifted centerline from a weighted average of 33 to 342.3 line days between severe injuries. The cumulative severe arterial catheter-associated proximal ischemic injuries incident rate decreased from its peak early in phase 1, April 2021, 5.65 per 1,000 line days, to the end of phase 2, December 2022, 2.11 per 1,000 line days. The overall rate of arterial line days per arterial catheter during phase 2 increased compared with pre-quarter 1 with a p-value less than 0.01 and phase 1 with a p-value less than 0.01. Conclusions. The development of a newly defined measurable harm index, arterial catheter-associated proximal ischemic injuries, and implementation of increased surveillance resulted in increased awareness and reduction of severe injury as measured by rates and line days between severe injuries in our critically ill patients. Protocolized management during phase 2, including introducing topical nitroglycerin as a therapeutic option, resulted in increased arterial catheter line days per catheter with sustained reduction in severe arterial catheter-associated proximal ischemic injury rates. Abstract 7 is a clinical investigation article by Good et al. Temporary femoral central venous catheter in the PICU, two-center retrospective cohort study of catheter tip position and symptomatic venous thromboembolism from 2016 to 2021. Objectives. We aim to determine the frequency and variables associated with low femoral central venous catheter or CVC tip position. We also examined the association between tip position and symptomatic venous thromboembolism or VTE. Design. Retrospective cohort from two PICUs. Setting. Quaternary Academic Children's Hospitals from 2016 to 2021. Patients. Children to age less than 18 years old in the PICU who underwent temporary femoral CVC placement. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Low femoral CVC tip position occurs when the tip is inferior to the fifth lumbar vertebrae on a post-procedural abdominal radiograph. Of 936 patients, 56.3% were 1 to 12 years old and 80% had normal weight for age Z-score. Femoral CVC tip position was low in 67.3% of patients. In the multivariable model, older age, earlier years of placement, and higher weight for age were associated with low femoral CVC tip position. Symptomatic femoral CVC-associated VTE occurred in 8.8% of patients, with a rate of 16.5 per 1,000 CVC days with an interquartile range of 13.1 to 20.5 per 1,000 CVC days. The percentage of VTE in low versus recommended femoral CVC tip position and VTE, 8.6% versus 9.2%, were equivalent, with two one-sided z-tests and a p-value less than 0.001. Furthermore, in the multivariable model, we failed to identify an association between low femoral CVC tip position relative to the recommended tip position and greater odds of VTE, with an odds ratio of 1.58 and a 95% confidence interval of 0.92 to 2.69. However, we cannot exclude the possibility of low femoral CVC tip position being associated with up to 2.6-fold greater odds of symptomatic VTE. Conclusions. In our two PICUs from 2016 to 2021, low femoral CVC tip position occurred in 2/3 of placements and was associated with older age and higher weight for age patients. Femoral CVC-associated VTE occurred in 1 in 11 catheter placements, with the raw percentage of femoral CVCs and subsequent VTE in low and recommended tip position being equivalent. However, the multivariable modeling indicates that future research into the relationship between tip position and VTE requires ongoing surveillance and work. Abstract 8 is a clinical investigation article by Cifra et al. Interfacility Transfer and Admission to PICUs in the United States, Survey of Referral Communications in 2023. Objectives. Poor communication during interfacility transfer to the PICU can harm critically ill children. Structured handoff communication can prevent harm. However, the landscape of interfacility referral communication practices across PICUs is unknown. Our objective was to describe interfacility referral communication practices among U.S. PICUs to begin identifying potential improvement opportunities. Design. Mixed method study, including a cross-sectional survey and semi-structured interviews. Setting. U.S. PICUs with greater than or equal to 10 beds in 2023. Participants. Clinical and or administrative PICU leaders. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. 60 surveys with greater than 70% completed questions were returned from 170 invited participants with 35% response rate. Respondents were mainly pediatric critical care medicine division chiefs, 48%, or PICU medical directors, 32%. PICUs in all U.S. continental regions were represented, which had a median of 1,200 admissions per year with an interquartile range of 1,000 to 1,500, of which 29.5% were patients directly transferred from other institutions with an interquartile range of 15 to 39%. In 93% of PICUs, a verbal interfacility handoff occurs between the referring clinician and a PICU physician. However, only 24% were always guided by a standard communication tool. In 72% of PICUs, medical records were only sometimes available before patient arrival. Semi-structured interviews with 7 volunteer respondents revealed the following themes. 1. Standardizing communication can result in organized and efficient handoffs but may also result in inefficiencies. 2. Trained staff dedicated to interfacility referrals will improve communication quality. 3. Integration of handoff information into the electronic health record will improve dissemination and decrease PICU physicians' workload. And 4. Implementing a structured process will require staff support to change current workflows. Conclusions. Referral communication for interfacility patient transfers to the PICU occurred mainly through unstructured verbal handoffs between referring clinicians and PICU physicians. PICU leaders identified several potential benefits and challenges of standardizing interfacility referral communication. Abstract 9 is a clinical investigation article by Rufiner et al. Extubation practices and outcomes during pediatric respiratory extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. Analysis of the Extracorporeal Life Support Organization Registry from 2018 to 2022. Objectives. To evaluate the outcomes associated with extubation during extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECMO, in pediatric patients. Design. Retrospective cohort study using the Extracorporeal Life Support Organization, or ELSO, registry from 2018 to 2022. Setting. Multicenter and international database of all ECMO centers in the ELSO registry. Patients. Patients between 30 days and 18 years old receiving pulmonary ECMO support. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Overall, 2,178 patients were included, of which 105 were extubated during ECMO support, or 4.8%. Analysis of pre-ECMO data failed to identify an association between extubation strategy and severity using the Pediatric Pulmonary Rescue with ECMO Prediction, or PPREP, score. Use of extubation versus not was associated with older age, with a median of 6.1 years versus 2.5 years and a p-value equal to 0.006, and longer ECMO duration, with a median of 12.9 days versus 7.1 days, with a p-value less than 0.0001. We failed to identify an association between the use of extubation versus not and ECMO complications. In a propensity matching analysis with 3-to-1 matching of non-extubated to extubated cases, mortality was 34.3% and 43.8% respectively, with a p-value equal to 0.08. In the matched subset, extubation versus not was associated with shorter median PICU length of stay after decannulation, 6.6 days versus 12.2 days, and a p-value equal to 0.001, and higher use of mobilization, 28.6% versus 9.8% with a p-value less than 0.0001. In a multivariable analysis, we failed to identify an association between using the extubation strategy versus not and greater odds of mortality, with an odds ratio of 1.74 and a 95% confidence interval of 0.94 to 3.27 with a p-value equal to 0.08. However, we cannot exclude the possibility that the use of an extubation strategy is associated with greater odds of mortality. Conclusions. In the 2018 to 2022 ELSO registry data, extubating pediatric patients on ECMO for pulmonary cause was an uncommon practice associated with improved mobility and decreased ICU length of stay after ECMO decannulation. However, given the concerns about mortality, careful consideration of patient candidacy and further studies are needed. Abstract 10 is a clinical investigation article by Barreto et al. Outcomes of pediatric veno-venous extracorporeal membrane oxygenation using dual lumen or multi-site cannulation, extracorporeal life support database study from 2000 to 2019. Objectives. In children reported to the Extracorporeal Life Support Organization or ELSO registry to compare mortality, the need for additional cannulas and complications associated with the dual lumen or multi-site cannulation for veno-venous extracorporeal membrane oxygenation or ECMO. Design. Multicenter retrospective study using the ELSO registry. Setting. Centers reporting to ELSO between January 1, 2000 and December 31, 2019. Patients included children 28 days to 18 years old supported with veno-venous ECMO. Interventions. We performed univariate and multivariable regression analyses to determine the association between veno-venous ECMO cannulation strategy and in-hospital mortality, ECMO duration, and need for additional cannulas. We also compared the frequency of veno-venous ECMO complications using univariate analysis. Measurements and main results. We identified a cohort of 2,034 patients, of whom 1,441 or 71% were supported with dual lumen cannulation. Support with dual lumen cannulation as opposed to multi-site cannulation was associated with younger age, 23 months with an interquartile range of 6 to 89 months versus 147 months with an interquartile range of 64 to 189 months and a p-value less than 0.001. We failed to identify an association between in-hospital mortality and whether dual lumen or multi-site cannulation had been used. 393 of 1,441 or 27% in dual lumen versus 184 of 593 or 31% in multi-site cannulation. Unadjusted and adjusted risk ratio of death was calculated using dual lumen as the reference group of 1.1 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.7 to 1.9 with a p-value equal to 0.7. The other analyses failed to identify an association between cannulation type, ECMO duration, and the use of additional cannulas. ECMO complications were similar except for more frequent neurologic determination of death in the multi-site group. Conclusions. In the 2000 to 2019 ELSO pediatric dataset, we failed to identify an association between veno-venous ECMO cannulation type, dual lumen or multi-site, and greater adjusted risk ratio of ECMO outcomes. Abstract 11 is a clinical investigation article by Copana Olmos et al. Sepsis in critically ill children in Bolivia, multicenter retrospective evaluation of the Phoenix criteria for sepsis in a 2023 cohort. Objectives. We evaluated the Phoenix criteria and the Phoenix sepsis score in a multicenter retrospective cohort of critically ill children with a clinical diagnosis of sepsis or septic shock in Bolivia. In addition, we aim to assess whether the management in a PICU at high altitude in the Bolivian Andes was associated with the performance of the respiratory dysfunction component in the Phoenix sepsis score. Design. Multicenter retrospective cohort study. Setting. 14 PICUs in Bolivia. Patients. Children admitted to the PICU with a clinical diagnosis of sepsis or septic shock from January 2023 to December 2023. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. There were 273 patients with a diagnosis of sepsis in 2023, of which 257, or 94.1%, met the 2024 Phoenix criteria for sepsis, and 166, or 60.8%, met the systemic inflammatory response syndrome, or SIRS-based criteria for sepsis. Among the 257 patients meeting Phoenix sepsis criteria, 86 died, or 33.5%. Of the patients with Phoenix-based sepsis, there were 100 of 257, or 38.9%, who were SIRS negative, and 27 of 100 died, or 27%. After correcting the oxygenation indices for altitude, 149 of 273 patients, or 54.6%, had a lower Phoenix respiratory score and an associated mortality more consistent with the expected mortality of the newly derived subscore. Patients at higher altitudes had higher hemoglobin levels and higher estimated oxygen carrying capacity, and these data were independently associated with lower odds of mortality after controlling for altitude-corrected Phoenix score. Conclusions. In this 2023 retrospective cohort of PICU patients with sepsis in Bolivia, we have found that the majority met the 2024 Phoenix sepsis criteria, but less than two-thirds met the SIRS-based criteria for diagnosis. However, the respiratory score in the Phoenix criteria overestimated the severity of respiratory dysfunction in more than half of the cohort, likely because the score does not take account of the Andean adaptation to high altitude with higher oxygen carrying capacity. Abstract 12 is a clinical investigation article by Roberts et al. Azithromycin for critically ill children with bronchiolitis, a U.S. Pediatric Health Information Systems Registry study from 2013 to 2022. Objectives: to estimate prescribing rates for azithromycin as immunomodulation among critically ill children hospitalized for acute bronchiolitis and identify institutional and chronological prescribing variation. Design: multicenter observational retrospective cohort study using the Pediatric Health Information Systems Registry from 2013 to 2022. Setting: 47 PICUs in the United States. Patients: critically ill children 0 to 3 years old hospitalized for acute viral bronchiolitis, excluding those prescribed azithromycin with alternative indication, IDEST concurrent Bordetella pertussis infection, urethritis, atypical pneumonia, acute upper respiratory infections, and asthma-related diagnoses. Interventions: azithromycin prescription during hospitalization. Measurements and main results. A total of 82,677 children met study criteria, of which 3,161, or 3.8%, were prescribed azithromycin. Mean center-specific azithromycin prescribing rates exhibited a multilinear decreasing trend, going from 4% plus or minus 4.6% in 2013 to 2.2% plus or minus 0.8% in 2022, or negative 0.7% per year. The median institutional azithromycin prescribing rate was 2.8%, with an interquartile range of 1.8 to 3.9% and a total range of 1.2 to 24.3%. Compared with those not prescribed azithromycin, receipt of azithromycin was associated with the following: older age, with a median of 10 months and an interquartile range of 3.2 to 20.3 months versus 7.8 months with an interquartile range of 2.9 to 15.2 months and a p-value less than 0.001, receiving corticosteroids 57.1% versus 38.1% with a p-value less than 0.001, or continuous albuterol 35.9% versus 22.4% with a p-value less than 0.001, use of non-invasive respiratory support 13.4% versus 9.7% and a p-value less than 0.001, or invasive ventilation 35.9% versus 22.4% with a p-value less than 0.001, and extracorporeal life support 0.5% versus 0.1% and a p-value less than 0.001. Conclusions. In this 2013 to 2022 U.S. multicenter registry-based cohort study, the azithromycin prescribing rate for critically ill children with bronchiolitis was 3.8%. Exposure varied by institution, patient age, and revealed a decreasing trend over the last decade. Abstract 13 is a PCCM trial by Furick et al. Parent attitudes to research without prior consent in two pediatric emergency clinical trials in Australia, a qualitative study of transcripts from 2017. Objectives: research in critically ill children poses challenges in acquiring prospective informed consent. International ethical guidelines generally have provisions to perform research without prior consent in circumstances where consent is not feasible, but there is a paucity of data regarding the community acceptance of this process. The objectives of the current study were to explore the attitudes and experiences of parents of children enrolled into trials to determine understanding and acceptability of research without prior consent to parents of children involved. Design: qualitative study of semi-structured telephone interviews in 2017 exploring themes of medical research and trial participation in research without prior consent. Interview transcripts underwent inductive thematic analysis with intercoder agreement using InVivo 14 software. Setting: two clinical interventional trials in Australia conducted in critically ill children without prospective consent. Subjects: parents of children enrolled in critical care research. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. A total of 49 interviews were conducted and analyzed. Parents of participants were supportive of processes used in the trials and research without prior consent. Paperwork was often not thought to contribute to improved understanding, with verbal information more valued. There was no consensus on the optimal approach of research without prior consent in situations when clinical outcome was poor. Conclusions. Our study in 2017 shows parent or carers supported research without prior consent in two pediatric trials involving critically ill children. Parents were satisfied with existing approval methods and safeguards. Parents valued brief verbal information at the time of randomization. These historical findings support the feasibility of conducting research on time-sensitive interventions in emergency settings with research without prior consent, aligning with community expectations. 14 is the PCCM narrative entitled A Music Producer's Perspective on the ICU. It is all about dynamic range compression. In my off-duty time, I spend many hours sitting alongside my teenage son. He's a young music producer, rapidly gaining knowledge and skills in the world of audio engineering. I enjoy observing him while he is working with great dedication on his impressive digital audio workstation. Over and over again, he intensely listens to audio signals, constantly tweaking various plug-in knobs and parameters to improve his sounds. After a busy shift full of tragedy in the PICU, just watching this process gives me enormous joy and welcome distraction. It is amazing how music can uplift your spirit. At the same time, it is inspiring to realize that music production may actually share many similarities with offering care to critically ill patients. As such, by interacting closely with my son, I am able to obtain new perspectives on my own work. In trying to keep up with his knowledge on the complexity of digital sound, my son explains to me various ways to modify audio signals. I learn that dynamic range compression is one of the obvious and most commonly applied tools in music production. Dynamic range compression reduces the dynamic range of the volume of an audio signal, thus decreasing the variability of the amplitude. It does so by attenuating loud parts, or downward compression, while amplifying soft parts, or upward compression, above and below a set threshold, respectively. During the process of dynamic range compression, the music producer is able to control and balance the extent, or gain change, gradient, or smoothness, and timing of such compression of the audio signal using a set of modifiable parameters. Here, I realize that one can easily draw an analogy with managing critically ill patients in the ICU, where the intensivist is confronted with a wide variety of choices regarding the deployment of supportive treatments. Failure to keep the human body in homeostasis necessitates treatments that either stimulate upward compression or dampen downward compression biological processes. For example, administering supplemental oxygen to a hypoxic patient would be a type of upward compression, while restricting oxygen therapy in an invasively ventilated patient with arterial hyperoxemia to avoid oxygen toxicity would represent downward compression. Yet, the extent, gradient, and timing by which such sometimes opposing strategies in supportive management of the ICU patient should be applied is often difficult to discern. In the early phase of critical illness, deficient responses may lead to lower bound physiological values. For example, hypoxia, hypotension, hypoventilation, in need of immediate control and stimulation. In contrast, supraphysiological conditions leading to upper bound extremes presenting later on during the course of ICU stay, for example, fluid overload, fever, hyperglycemia, often require more gradual restrictive and attenuating treatments. Put in this way, one could consider it the intensivist's most important job to try to keep the ICU patient's trajectory as smooth as possible, or boring in terms of variability, by avoiding the upper and lower extremes, thus applying dynamic range compression. With this, there is a constant moving back and forth between an aggressive versus so-called less is more approach, it est how much and how quick is compression needed, depending on how fast and hard a patient veers off course beyond the normal reference values. Both rapid transient peaks as well as slow deviating trends in the clinical variables of a patient need to alert the clinician to undertake action. Not surprisingly, artificial intelligence algorithm use is growing in music production as well as in the ICU for its utility in recognizing such patterns. Sitting next to my son makes me realize we are all doing similar things, just in a different setting. In the end, when applying dynamic range compression in music productions, it is all about trying to obtain a more consistent and smoother signal that yields the perfect output mix for the input of a wide variety of sounds, instruments, and vocal recordings. Without it, an indistinct mush of sound may occur not fitted to the purpose, genre, or emotion of the song. Applying different compression parameter settings to different parts over the entire audio frequency spectrum, or multiband compression, can greatly aid in this process, and it is here that the analogy seems to be most strong. Similar to music producers, ICU clinicians need to balance all clinical input from the various interacting and sometimes conflicting organ systems, channeling this mix toward a good quality of life output, while taking into account patient and family needs, beliefs, and emotions. Such holistic approach is unique for the general intensivist and music producer alike, and this is what makes the profession so important and rewarding. At this point, I appreciate the power of cross-disciplinary thinking. A simple change of perspective always helps one to explore and analyze their own context and challenges. This promotes novel problem-solving approaches and enhances decision-making as well as professional satisfaction. In my case, viewing my critical care profession from the perspective of a music producer stimulates me to push harder in maintaining the overall and broader view on what really matters for the outcome of my patients. To me, looking at my own work through the eyes of my son helps me further appreciate the true value of being a pediatric intensivist. This concludes the abstracts for the May 2025 issue of Pediatric Critical Care Medicine. Thank you very much for listening. For more journal-related content, including access to the articles mentioned in this recording, please visit pccmjournal.org. Members of the SCCM Pediatric Section receive complimentary access to the PCCM Journal.